The last months of Jesus' ministry on earth, he turned his time and his attention to the regions of Judea and Perea. In the final 6 months of his time here on earth, he spent much of that time divided between Judea from the Feast of Tabernacles to the Feast of Dedications in the fall and the winter, and then into Perea from the Feast of Dedications to Passover. John chapter 10 and verse 40 records Jesus' withdrawal to Perea after the Feast of Dedication. It's during that time in Judea, during the winter of 30 and 31 AD, that he taught about his identity as the Messiah, the anointed of God. And in doing so, he taught using the figure of a shepherd. Word pictures and analogies and parables are some of the primary vehicles that Jesus used to teach about his divinity. I am the bread of life, John 6. I am living water, John 4. And here in John chapter 10, he makes the spiritual application, particularly in regard to his deity, from what was probably the most familiar image of ancient Palestine, a shepherd and his flock. In our modern and urban culture, we seem to lose much of the impact and the depth of Jesus' teaching because of our ignorance or our lack of connection to agriculture. The Hebrew people of that time were an agrarian, pastoral people. They lived on the land. They lived close to the land. And although God's Word is authoritatively timeless, we need to consider and study it as it was written to the people of that culture and that time. So what we're going to think about in the next few moments, in the balance of our time today, is we're going to think about the significance of this image. I'm going to give you some background about this agrarian culture, and then we're going to turn to the message of John 10. Personal note, in 1998, my family and I were faced with a tragedy. We lost my wife's father. And we moved home to manage the farm that she grew up on. And at that time, I violated 3 of promises that I made to myself when I was a young man leaving East Tennessee to go into the Army. I said, I'll never be a farmer, I'll never be a preacher, and I'm never going to move back to Tennessee. I violated all of that in one day. So I went back to Tennessee. Started the local work with the congregation there and became a farmer. Now, I grew up working on farms being what we called a gopher. I would go for this and go for that, and I would hold stuff and go get stuff and drive stuff, but I didn't pay attention to the process. In my mind, this is the end of that. I'm going off and doing bigger things. And so I didn't pay attention, and here I found myself now a bona fide, real, sure enough farmer. And I was terrible at it, at least at the beginning. I think I ended up turning into a pretty tolerable farmer. But one day, one of the girls came in. As many of you who grew up in rural areas, you know a little bit about the 4-H. And one of the girls came in, our two oldest girls, and said, Daddy, we want to do a 4-H project. And I thought, you know, build a birdhouse, you know, public speaking, something like that. No big deal. And they said, we want to raise sheep. And I thought to myself, how hard can that be? It just looks like they're big dogs. It can't be too bad. And so I said, you know, we as parents were always all in on whatever our children were interested in. So we said, sure, let's jump into it. And boy, what an education I got. Got a big education in farming, got a big education in sheep, cattle. But at the same time, while beginning my career as a preacher and raising sheep, all of a sudden, some passages that had kind of been, I kind of sort of knew what they were about, became deep. Where it really impacted you. And so I'll give you one example. I was with my second daughter one time in the barn. We had some brood sheep in there, some ewes. And one of them had some trouble with the lamb grafting onto her, and so we had her pinned up and were working with it. And we went to check on her in the morning, and this ewe had literally stuck her head through one fence, turned to 90 degree angles, stuck her head through another fence, and thrashed so hard through the night that she broke her neck. And we found her dead with two lambs, you know, wandering about, and now you've got to graft them onto another ewe or raise them on the bottle or whatever. And it really hit me at the time, and I told my daughter, I said, Katie, I said, how helpless that animal is. And it was its own worst enemy, is how God looks at us. And I began to learn these lessons. I said, there's really something here. And so I jumped into this as a research project, and I want to share some of that with you this morning, particularly from John 10. To do that, we need to talk a little bit about this ancient occupation. And so there are two types of parables that are agriculture. Remember, this is an agrarian culture. They understood. Everybody in ancient Israel at this time was either a farmer or knew somebody. It's similar to the United States in the 18th and 19th, even into the early 20th century. Almost everybody either farmed or knew somebody. And so you've got some general agricultural parables, the sower, the wheat, and the tares, mustard seed, and so on. But a lot of them are about livestock. They're about sheep. Cattle was not a big product in the ancient world. It was sheep and it was goats. That was the primary ones. And so we're going to think a little bit about this shepherd. We're going to think about some of the images. All of these pictures are taken. I didn't take these pictures. These pictures are taken and brought to us from Israel. So the historical character has changed a little over the past 5,000 years. Now, Hebrew today, contemporary Jewish shepherds no longer live in that style. But Arabic Bedouins do. They still live the same way that they did thousands of years ago. And there were certain grades of shepherds. One of the grades of the shepherds was the proprietor. He owned the sheep and was ultimately responsible for their care. The other one was known as a herdsman. A herdsman is a tenant farmer in American parlance. He was not an owner, but he worked and was paid with a portion or a percentage of everything that the proprietor took. So fleece, hair, milk, meat, hides, the entire thing. And he also incurred a percentage of the loss and was there affected by predation and disease. Here's an example. Jacob, in Genesis chapter 31, was a tenant farmer, worked for his uncle Laban for 20 years. Amos chapter 7, verses 12 through 15, the great prophet to Israel, was a herdsman. Doeg the Edomite was the chief herdsman of Saul in 1 Samuel. The other grade was a hireling. Jesus is going to talk about the hireling in John 10. He was simply a day wage farmhand. He showed up in the morning, he worked all day, he got a paycheck at the end of the day, and he walked away no matter what happened that day to the flock, no matter what happened to the farm. We also need to understand the great diversity of land that existed in this place. Palestine is an interesting place. There is great diversity, and what ended up happening was they would travel following the grass, much like if we would go back in our own history to the 1800s, much like the great cattle herds did out west. They followed the grass. It was open range. And so all of these flocks would travel this cyclic route, north and south, just constantly from Dan to Beersheba on both sides of the Jordan River. And they had a home base, but that was their travel. That's the way that they made their living. And it was a very diverse land. It was well watered. In Deuteronomy chapter 8 and verse 7, we are told it was a land of brooks, of water, of fountains and springs that flow out of the valleys and hills. And so it was a land that was made for a pastoral living. It had grass and it had water, and that's what you need to raise those animals. But it also had long dry spells that would require putting up water, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. Central to all of this, in numerous biblical references, is what is known as the sheepfold. The sheepfold was nothing but a rock enclosure, generally outside of a cave. A lot of times they put them outside of a cave and give them a little bit more room. And those sheepfolds were spread all over Israel at the time. And so, Numbers chapter 32 and verse 16, for instance, Moses said to the tribes of Reuben and Gad, "Build folds for your sheep." Judges chapter 5 and verse 16, It is used metaphorically by Deborah. Why do you sit among the sheepfolds to hear the pipings for the flocks? Talking about leadership. And today, Jesus is going to talk to us in John 10 about being the door of the sheep, or the door of the sheepfold. We'll talk about that a little bit later. The sheepfold really represents the seriousness that these shepherds took for care of their sheep. They didn't leave them out overnight, exposed to primarily predators. And as you might expect, there was one central portion in that sheepfold that was often divided. You put sheep on the right and goats on the left. You would actually separate them at night because goats and sheep don't always get along together in enclosed spaces. There was a courtyard open to the sky, in Hebrew known as the Sarai. In Psalms chapter 27 and verse 5, "For in the time of trouble he made me hide in my pavilion, in the secret place of his tabernacle he shall hide me. He shall set me high upon a rock." That word pavilion is the Hebrew Sarai. David is thinking back to the times that he sat in the sheepfold and sat there in the courtyard of the sheepfold and looked to the sky and prayed to God. In Psalms 27 and verse 5, "For in time of trouble he shall..." Zechariah chapter 11, "For indeed I will raise up a shepherd in the land who will not care for those who are cut off, nor seek the young, nor heal those who are broken, nor feed those who shall stand, but will eat the flesh of the fat and tear their hooves in pieces." The prophecy of a bad leader given in that. And so these sheepfolds were all over the... We're all over the ancient world, and you can see some examples of them there. At the beginning of the day, in the morning near the sunrise, the shepherd would come out to the door of the flock, and there would be many, many flocks within that single sheepfold. And this is something that still happens among Bedouin tribesmen today. The shepherds would show up, and the women and the children would predominantly go in, and they would milk the sheep, they would milk the goats, they would take that milk and as they would use during the day. After milking the sheep, they would move them to their pastures. And the way they did it is that all the shepherds would come to the opening of the sheepfold, they would open the sheepfold, and the shepherds would begin walking in different directions, singing their songs, and the sheep would self-select into their shepherd. Now, I didn't want to tell you something. I didn't used to believe that when I heard people talking about that until I became a shepherd. And I could step into my pasture. I won't humor you with my call, but I could step into my pasture and I could call, and those sheep would come running and they would stand around me. And when I first started raising sheep, I'd raise cattle before I'd raise sheep. Cattle you drive, sheep you lead. And so when I got the sheep, I just treated them like small cows. And so I wanted them to go from point A to point B. I'd get behind them and kind of push them, and they'd all turn around and look at me. And so I'd go behind them and try to push them, and they'd all turn around and look at me. And finally, I have to make a mistake 6-7 times for it to take effect. Finally, I said, maybe they'll just follow me. And so I would go where I wanted them to go, and bigger than the world, they'd just get in line and follow right on your heels. But I could go on vacation, and somebody knew, a neighbor could come by, and he could call, and they'd come to the top of the hill and put on the brakes. And they'd stand there and say, "Who are you?" And that was it. They didn't want any part to that. They knew their master's voice. We'll come back to that a little bit later on. After they went into the pasture, and after they moved to the pasture, the ewes with the young and the sick and the injured, those that were too young to move to the pasture, would remain at home with the children. Song of Solomon, chapter 1 and verse 8, alludes to this. "If you do not know, O fairest among women, follow in the footsteps of the flock and feed your little goats beside the shepherd's tents." He's giving us a glimpse of that day-to-day life of the shepherd and their families. Between 10 and 11 in the morning, the shepherd would lead the flock to water at some sort of water containment. And they are all over Israel today. And so this is an example in the Jordan River Valley. They would lead him to some place like this. This is a natural water source. Here is another water source that is a spring from a cave. AJ and Randy took us to a beautiful spring yesterday and showed us that. So it's very similar to what they would have used. Here is the Inherid spring. This is up in the vicinity of Mount Carmel. This is the Gibeon water shaft. This is just an example of what they would have built to store water through the dry months of the years in Palestine. This is a great example that gives us a little insight into how they operated. This is a man-made water hole in the Judean wilderness. And if you will notice, these indentations at the bottom, that was to catch the overflow of the water. Because what the shepherd would do is he would carry two leather buckets with him through the day. And when he was ready to water, he'd set one leather bucket down and he would pull water out of that water hole with the second leather bucket, and he would overflow that bucket that he had on the ground to keep it clean and keep it fresh. And therefore, in Psalms 23, when David says, "My cup overfloweth," that's the image you should get. That's what he's talking about. He's not talking about a wine cup overflowing. That's not what he's talking about. He's talking about the bucket that I feed my sheep. Lord, you've filled my bucket up and it is overflowing, which means you're a good shepherd. You want me to have fresh, clean, abundant water. But it was also designed so that what overflowed went back into the cistern and was not lost. And so they would water. All of these water sources were communal. Remember, Jacob met Rachel at a communal water source. Moses met Jethro's daughter at a communal water source. And we hear, and there were natural water sources that were used as well. The still waters of Psalms 23 and the deep waters of Ezekiel 34. They would literally build wing dams to create small still pools in stream, because a sheep has a hard time drinking from moving water, because it hits their nose and it chokes them and they can't drink. And so they would, taking care of these sheep, would put a wing dam in that stream where there would be still water so that they could drink from. And so when you hear that in Psalms 23, that's the image that he is conveying. And then they would rest at noon. They would go to some place and they would rest at noon. And in Psalms 23, he makes me lie down in green pastures. That's what he's making a reference to. And then they would go to another sheepfold and they would bed down at night. Jeremiah 33 gives us the image of this. "Thus says the Lord of hosts, in this place which is desolate without man and without beast, and in all the cities, there shall again be a dwelling place of shepherds causing their flocks to lie down. In the cities of the mountains, in the cities of the lowland, in the cities of the south, in the land of Benjamin, in the places around Jerusalem, and in the cities of Judah, the flock shall again pass under the hands of him who counts them, says the Lord." Ezekiel 20 gives us the idea, "I will make you pass under the rod, and I will bring you into the land of the covenant." And what he's talking about is when they would arrive at a sheepfold, at the one single opening in the sheepfold, he would take his rod, the shepherd would take his rod, and he would lay it down over that so he could count the sheep coming in. And he would know exactly how many he had. He knew exactly how many he was supposed to have. If there was one missing, he'd go look for it. If there was one extra, he was going to figure it out. But that was the time of accounting. And what that means, the Lord uses it this way in Ezekiel, it is making a covenant. In other words, if you pass under the rod, I'm letting you in. If you're not supposed to be here, I'm going to kick you out. But it was the image of making a covenant. Then they would separate the sheep from the goat. We talked about that just a moment ago. The shepherd was the most familiar thing that these people knew. His apparel was common. He had the distinguishing robe, the leather belt, the cloak, the headdress. I'm going to come back to this passage at the conclusion of our lesson, but I want to share it with you in Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 11. "He will feed his flock like a shepherd. He will gather the lambs with his arm and carry them in his bosom and gently lead them to where you lead them. Lead those who are with young." Let me describe that carrying in his bosom. We get the image. We get kind of the gushy image of us laying our head on the Lord's chest. That's not what he's saying. He's describing it in shepherd's terms. A shepherd would take his cloak and he would bind it around him with a leather belt. And in that belt, he would put his rod and his staff and very often David's sling and sometimes a small short sword to keep the predators off. But that would form a pocket in his cloak. And as he would move from one spot to another, he would reach down and he would take the lambs that couldn't keep up, and he would put them in his pocket. And sometimes a shepherd would have 10, 12 little lambs with their heads kind of hanging out of his cloak, walking across the fields to get them back to their mothers. That's the image that Isaiah is talking about. In other words, when I can't keep up, the Lord will pick me up and carry me in His cloak in His bosom like a shepherd would. That's the image that is invoked in that. And so we see the figures of a shepherd that are used in the New Testament. The shepherd of Christ, elders are sometimes referred to this, Acts chapter 20. So you've got two different contexts that are being used. One of Christ universal and second one of elders in a local sense. And you also have certain figures of the sheep. That means something. And just generally, it's God's people. Either Israel in the Old Testament and some of the New Testament. Prospective disciples in Matthew chapter 9. The apostles in Matthew chapter 26. But generally what they are talking about are disciples in general. Let's look at our text. At the conclusion of John chapter 9, you have a situation going on where Jesus has healed a blind man. And he's healed this blind man. The blind man went on his way. And the Pharisees, verse 13 of chapter 9, they brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now, it was the Sabbath day when Jesus had made the mud and opened his eyes. I don't have to tell you what's going to happen if Jesus healed somebody on the Sabbath day and the Pharisees found out about it. They took exception. Forget the fact that a man who was blind now sees. I don't know. I've never been able to understand that they were so wrapped around the axle about it being the Sabbath day that they missed the miracle. But he performs this miracle. We've seen this dozens of times in the New Testament. And so we're going to come down to kind of the questioning. So they begin to question him about this and talk to him. And the idea is he can't be a man of God because he violated the Sabbath restrictions. Now, he didn't violate the Sabbath restrictions. He violated the Pharisees' interpretation of the Sabbath restrictions at the time. It was a man-made interpretation. It wasn't God's interpretation. And the conclusion of this man, that the last clause of verse 17 is, he is a prophet. Now, this blind man is saying he is a prophet. He's not there yet either. But he does recognize, even being a blind man, I know this is not normal. I can recognize that. You can't. You're the ones that seem to have the problem. And so, as you'll recall, they bring in mom and dad. Mom and dad take the easy way out. Mom and dad say, look, he's a grown man. You deal with him. We're out. We're not gonna deal with this. And so it comes down to, they bring the man back, and they begin to deal with Jesus, and in verse 35, I want to pick up there. Jesus heard that they had cast him out. And having found him, he said, do you believe in the Son of Man? He answered, and who is he, sir, that I may believe in him? Jesus said to him, you have seen him, and it is he who is speaking to you. He said, Lord, I believe. And he worshipped him. Jesus said, for judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind. Some of the Pharisees near him heard these things and said to him, are we also blind? Jesus said to them, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say we see, your guilt remains. Let's pull on this thread a little bit. Let me unpack this a little bit for you. Jesus has healed a blind man. The blind man is rightfully impressed by this. The Pharisees have an issue about it. This passage is about identity and vision. This is about the ability of someone to look at the evidence and understand and identify Jesus of Nazareth as the Hebrew Messiah. That's what 9 and 10 are about. It's not about healing. It's not about that. It's really about, can you see that Jesus is the Messiah? Jesus approaches the man that had been healed. Do you believe? He said, do you believe in the Son of Man? Well, tell me who he is and I'll believe in him because I'm impressed. And he says, you have seen him and it is he who is speaking to you. And he says, Lord, I believe. In other words, I was a blind man, but I can see. I can see without my physical eyes that you are the Messiah. So I'm in. You've convinced me. He begins to worship him. Jesus says, for judgment I came into this world that those who do not see. Now take this apart carefully. That those who do not see physically, the blind man, may see spiritually that I am the Messiah. And now he's going to flip it over. Those who see physically become blind to the fact that he is the Messiah. Jesus is using wordplay, as he often does. Some of the Pharisees heard him. They didn't miss it. And let me tell you something else. They didn't miss the fact that he was talking about them. They completely understood that was a shot at us. And so they asked, are we also blind? Now Jesus makes it a little more elaborate, but I'll tell you, the short answer is yes. Yes, in fact, you are blind. He says, if you were blind physically, like this man that I've healed, you would have no guilt. Why? Because you could see that the Son of Man is the Son of God. But now that you say we see physically, our eyeballs work, your guilt remains because you have rejected the Messiah. This passage is about identity and vision. It's about understanding Jesus of Nazareth as the Son of God and the Messiah that has come to give us a hope of salvation. To try to explain this, Jesus turns to, in John 10, to the image, the great image of the agrarian shepherd. Let's read again verses 1 through 6. Truly, truly, I say to you, he who does not enter the sheepfold by the door but climbs in by another way, that man is a thief and a robber. But he who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. To him the gatekeeper opens. The sheep hear his voice, and he calls his own sheep by name and leads them out. When he has brought out all his own, he goes before them, and the sheep follow him, for they know his voice. A stranger they will not follow, but they will flee from him, for they do not know the voice of the stranger. And so hopefully some of that imagery that I unpacked for you a moment ago makes that more clear. He's talking about hearing a voice. We heard him and we know who it is. We recognize, in other words, again, identity and vision. I've got the vision and the understanding to know and identify that that's my master. That's my Savior. That's Jesus of Nazareth. And he talks about enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. In other words, if you're calling, you know, look, every one of us understand this. I've got a key to my house, and when I want to go in and out of my house, I use my key. If somebody's crawling through my bedroom window, I can make a pretty clear assumption that they're not supposed to be there. Right? Now, I'm a little bit more cautious about that because every now and then my teenage kids would get locked out, and mom and dad's bedroom window was the easiest one to crack. So they, you know, they if they couldn't get in touch with it, that's how they snuck in. And so we recognize there's some authority here. Jesus is saying, I'm the shepherd. I walk right through the door. I come through the door. And he's going to build on that in a moment. But then we see in verse 6, for all of this figure that they should have understood, this figure of speech Jesus used with them, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. So what does Jesus do? He doubles down. He just keeps going. He keeps hammering away at this imagery. Truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. All who came before me are thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved, and he will go in and out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I came that they may have life and have it abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He who is a hired hand and not a shepherd, who does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and flees, and the wolf snatches them and scatters them. He flees because he is a hired hand and cares nothing for the sheep. I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me. Just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. And I have other sheep that are not of this fold. I must bring them also, and they will listen to my voice. So there will be one flock, one shepherd. For this reason the Father loves me, because I lay down my life that I may take it again. No one takes it from me, but I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This charge I have received from my Father. Now we can see in verse 19 what the conclusion will be. There was again a division among the Jews because of these words. Many of them says he has a demon and is insane. Why listen to him? Others said, these are not the words of one who is oppressed by a demon. Can a demon open the eyes of the blind? Identity and vision. Real spiritual vision. And so let's take apart verses 7 and following. He says, truly, truly, I say to you, I am the door of the sheep. He is bringing these people back to the familiar image that they know about. So let me explain this to you really quickly. Here is a sheepfold in Palestine, and you'll notice a Bedouin man sitting there in the door. This is the door. This is the single door right here, and a Bedouin gentleman is standing there. He is the shepherd. He is known as the door of the sheep. The sheepfolds didn't have gates on them in ancient times. The shepherd would spend his night laying in the gap of that sheepfold. He would pull his cloak around him. He would take his rod and his staff, prepared to defend them. And he would lay down in the opening. The idea is, you can't get out without going over me, and a predator can't get in without going over me. When Jesus says, I am the door of the sheep, he is saying, I am the one who controls access in and out of the body. I won't let predators get to you, and I won't let you out without objection. I'm controlling access. Anybody who climbs up and over, remember this is about identity. Anybody who climbs up and over, he says, all who came before me, there were plenty who came before him, brethren. We've got a couple of examples in New Testament writings in the book of Acts. In Acts chapter 5, a man by the name of Gamaliel stands up, and he makes the point and mentions two previous Messiah movements. One by the name of Judas, and the other one named by the name of Thutis. He stood up and he made the point. They came before and they got a bunch of people riled off, and they took them off, and they were creating all kinds of problems. This was a messianic period where more than one person jumped up and said, I'm the one that you've been waiting on. Led a bunch of people off, got them in trouble, took them off in the wrong direction. And Gamaliel's conclusion was, if this is nothing, if Peter and John are nothing, if they are something like Thutis, they'll fall. They'll go the same way. But if they are from God, do we really want to be found standing in their way? We may talk more about that this evening. So there had been others before him, but he says, I am the door. If anyone enters by me, he will be saved and will go in and out and find pastures. In other words, he'll be in my flock. Notice also verse 11. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. He who is a hired hand. Now we go back to this hireling, a day wage, a day laborer. Look, every one of us has probably faced some kind of little peril in our life. And I've spent a lot of my time out in the woods, and I've done the whole outdoor thing. And I've had some scary moments with large fauna and predators. And I will tell you, you wouldn't be able to pay me a day wage enough to risk my life with a bear or a wolf over a sheep. You can forget it. Doesn't make any difference how good you're paying me on that day. I'm not fighting a bear over that sheep. But when I was a shepherd, and it was my responsibility, and they were mine, and it was my duty to go out and face the predator. Now, thankfully, we don't do it much like that. You know, the biggest predator we had to worry about were coyotes and dogs. But remember young David? When they pull him out of the field, and he wants to go face this uncircumcised Philistine, and they've got this little 12, 13-year-old boy standing there, and say, well, how can you do that? Well, what's his response? I've been out in the field. I'm the one out in the field while my brothers are doing other things. I'm the one out with the flock, being a shepherd, fighting off the bear and the wolf. Don't tell me I'm not courageous. Don't tell me I can't fight. I can fight. Jesus is saying, I'm not a hireling. When the predator shows up, I'll be there for you. I'll be there. He goes on to say, I lay down my life for my sheep. And he goes on to say, I do it voluntarily. Nobody's forcing me into this. I do it voluntarily. And because I lay down my life, I can take it up again. I lay it down of my own accord. I have authority to lay it down, and I have authority to take it up again. This charge I have received from my Father. Jesus is trying to convince them of identity and vision. He's trying to convince these Pharisees, please have the spiritual vision to recognize that I am who I say I am. And that is a beautiful image. At least I think it is. When we come down to the fact that Jesus reminds us that He is the Good Shepherd, the lessons for the sheep are that we have reliance upon the Shepherd. Reliance for salvation. The Shepherd entering by the door. The reliance for sustenance. That He will lead us out to good pastures. The reliance for protection from ourselves. There is a reason that He gave us a law and a covenant. And when I think about this passage and when I think about Jesus as my Shepherd, I always go back to that Isaiah moment in Isaiah 40 when I imagine my Lord as I am stumbling and struggling to keep up like a little lamb, that He reaches down and He grabs me and the others who are struggling and He puts me inside of that cloak and He carries me where I can't walk myself. I think that is a beautiful image. It is an image we need to go back to and we need to ponder upon. It's an image to recognize that we need to have the vision to identify Him as our Savior. That's ultimately what this passage is about. Today, if you have not claimed Him as your Savior, you can do so. If you've never obeyed the gospel of Christ, you can hear it, you can study it, you can have faith built on what you've read and what you've studied and what you've concluded from His Word. You can be willing to turn your life around and transform it through the gospel of Christ. You can confess Him in ways that these Pharisees were not willing to do, but the blind man was. You can have vision to see and confess that He is the Son of God. You can be immersed in the waters of baptism to rise up and to walk in newness of life, being resurrected a new body, a new person, completely transformed to go on and live your life. If you're here, in any way subject to the invitation, we offer it to you while we stand and sing.